It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll learn about some of the coolest news from the science world, including some of the hard facts behind popular aging claims and things you didn't know about carnivorous plants.
First, a new bill would allow people to replace, rebuild, or transfer high-capacity water wells without state approval.
The bill is making some environmentalists nervous. They say it would remove important oversight, and that could lead to wasted groundwater. Supporters of the bill say it removes unnecessary bureaucratic hassle.
Senator Rick Gudex is the main author of the bill. He's a Republican state senator from the Fond du Lac area. Senator Gudex, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Why is it a priority for you to change the way high-capacity water well permits are given right now?
Well, you know, I come from a district that has a lot of agriculture, and I'm also, talking with members of the local Farm Bureau, and it come to my attention that, we have this kind of gray area out there right now as it pertains to high-capacity wells. So, you know, we decided that we were going to draft a bill that basically did three things. And the three things that that bill does is it allows the transfer of a property, whether it's to someone within the immediate family or as a sale outside of the family, that the high-capacity well that is on that property goes with the sale of the property. And the reason why we're considering doing this is because if you were to sell your property, your farm, whatever operation you have, whether you have one or two or three high-capacity wells, if you were to sell that property and not have the certainty that that well permit that the DNR gave doesn't go with the property, that diminishes the value of the property. So we wanted to make sure that, you know, the well was permitted under current guidelines from the DNR, that just because of the property transfers doesn't mean that the well and the permit come up as under review, because what that does is, again, it just puts uncertainty into the process of the sale.
Now, is that something you've been seeing among your constituents? There's a transfer of property,
yeah,
and then the property permit or the well permit for the next owner is denied, in effect?
The question has arisen because of the Lake Beulah decision that came up a couple years ago. And the legislature last session tried to take an approach to remedy the uncertainty that's out there as a direct result of the Lake Beulah decision. And there, like I said, there's this gray area out there right now, and the farming community is very apprehensive when it comes to this because they have heard from others within the farming community that this could be a situation that comes up. And again, it goes back to the value of the property.
So tell us about the Lake Beulah decision. What is that?
Well, the Lake Beulah decision came up, was back in 2011, and landowners and the clean water people discovered that there was a amount of water being drawn from the lake that was due to high capacity wells. So there were some lawsuits that took place, and as a result of the lawsuits, there's this gray area now as to what happens with high capacity wells here in the state of Wisconsin. This bill doesn't address in any way, shape, or form adding new wells in the state of Wisconsin. That process is still under the way it's always been done. What this bill does is it addresses only wells that currently exist, and the transfer of those wells, the reconstruction of those wells, or the replacement, the direct replacement of those wells within 75 feet of the original well.
So you're seeing concern there that the permit could be denied when the property transfers. Have you had any actual cases of that happening, of that permit being denied so far?
I haven't had any instances where it has happened. There's a lot of uncertainty out there, and what we're trying to do with this bill is make sure that we have certainty that when these things take place, that they will be able to transfer their property, reconstruct a well, or replace a well.
Now, environmentalists who oppose the bill say it could mean the end of DNR well reviews because these permits are a point of entry for the DNR to get in, make sure the well water output is what it should be. What do you say to that point?
Well, the point of entry exists whether this bill goes through or not. The point of entry comes in under the public trust doctrine under 30.03 of the state statute, which is very clear. The DNR also has the capability of using state statute 281.34, which gives the DNR the ability to modify or rescind an approval. So, you know, there is plenty of opportunity to allow the DNR to step in when they feel it's necessary. We just want to make sure that they're going to do that when it's necessary and not in all cases as what's being currently avoided right now. We want to make sure that we can do these things, these simple things like replace a pump on a well without having the DNR come in and reassess that well and its attribute to the surrounding area.
We're speaking right now with Senator Rick Gudex, Republican state senator from the Fond du Lac area. He's with us to talk about a new bill he's proposing that would allow changes to high-capacity water wells without DNR approval. And let's talk a little bit about that DNR approval. How do you think the process is working so far?
Well, right now, the situation is that the DNR, whether there's a transfer or a maintenance issue, the DNR has to be notified. That will not change. They will still need to be notified of the replacement or of the replacement of a well, replacement of a pump, you know, whether they're going to enhance the well so that they can still have their current output. That all takes place yet with a notification. What we have right now is that there's always the situation where the DNR can step in and take a look at that site and inspect that site, and they've pretty much done that throughout the case, where they've come in and they've looked at those sites. And you know what we're trying to avoid is that the well would be deemed or changed in the permitting process because of what the DNR may have had, because the DNR may have had some indications that there's something in the area that's gone awry because of the wells.
So with your proposed bill, if the DNR takes a look at that well, sees maybe the output is more than it should be, just for example, would they have the power to make a citation to ask for change, even though they're not involved as closely in the permitting process?
Well, that happens right now. The high-capacity wells require an annual report regarding their output. So there is that annual check right now to make sure that they're not taking any more water out of that well than what the permit allows. So that won't change under this bill.
And about who's affected here, is this primarily farmers or are there others here that we're thinking of?
Well, it could be agricultural relating to the farming industry or the vegetable growers or any other kind of agricultural segment that requires a high-capacity well permit. It could be vegetable canners and any other processes like that.
Now, have you heard about any other legislation that might be taking a look at these high-capacity wells? It sounds as though other Republicans might be thinking along similar lines and maybe planning similar legislation.
Yeah, Senator Coles has been working on a high-capacity well bill that actually starts to deal with siting of new wells and what is required or what should be required for new wells. This bill, again, doesn't do anything with new wells. It only deals with current wells and the current permit governing that well.
Senator Gudex, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was Senator Rick Gudex, Republican state senator from the Fond du Lac area. He was with us to talk about his new bill that would allow changes to high-capacity water wells without DNR approval. To look at the science behind some popular aging claims in our regular science news segment with Gemma Tarlag. She also has some fun facts to share about carnivorous plants and how ancient footprints can tell us a lot about our ancestors.
Gemma Tarlag is a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us once a month. Gemma, welcome back to the show.
Hey, great to be with you again.
So, good news, our lifespans tend to be increasing. Bad news, we don't always know how to age healthfully and well, and that's one of the issues you focus on in this month's edition of Discover Magazine. You take a look at a lot of popular claims about aging. First, give us a broad strokes. What's the current state of the art when it comes to getting older?
Well, when it comes to getting older, not only are we all doing it, but we're all doing it just proportionately at a higher rate than ever. We've got 10,000 baby boomers turning 65 every day. So a lot of us are getting up there in years, and as you can imagine, just about all of us are eager to make sure that, you know, that part of our life is just as vigorous and rewarding as the rest of it. So we're looking at really two kind of main prongs of research. Research into lifestyle, and then really deep into a cellular level, looking at ways of actually rejuvenating aging cells, whether they be brain cells or even muscle and bone cells.
Well, one difficult thing that many Americans have to cope with as they age is dementia or Alzheimer's, and there's been a lot of Alzheimer's research over the years. What do we know now about whether or not Alzheimer's is preventable and maybe reversible?
Well, actually, this goes exactly with that kind of two-prong approach to the research. There was a small study done last year that had really fascinating results. They put people with dementia, only 10 people total in the study, so a very small study, but they put them on this very rigorous 36-point program. It involved what they ate, when they slept, how they exercised, etc. And they found 9 of the 10 people actually showed improvement in their memory and cognitive impairment. So this is actually suggesting that lifestyle could be a big factor in how you stave off or even improve yourself after, dementia and memory loss has set in. So that's really promising, but very, very small study, so I don't want to oversell it. And on the flip side of the coin, they are looking at new ways of imaging the plaques and tangled proteins that actually we think cause Alzheimer's. And by imaging them, they're going to be able to develop much more targeted therapeutics, much better drugs that can really get at the problem. That's years away. Again, I don't want to oversell it, but it's really promising and exciting research.
Well, it's a huge step because, as I think I read previously, an autopsy was the only way to detect these things, obviously past when it's useful. So now we can actually detect those signs when we're still alive, potentially.
Exactly, exactly. They're developing new techniques to actually, look into the brain as it's firing and start to identify areas that are operating abnormally, areas that are growing abnormally, et cetera, and they're really untangling it all. As you can imagine, the brain is incredibly complex, especially the human brain, but they're making significant inroads into imaging it that will lead, a little further down the road, will lead to much better drugs, much better targeted drugs.
And, of course, people who face aging want to know what they can do to be proactive and be counter whatever it is they may be coming up against. And one of the things we keep hearing about is sort of brain workouts, almost treating your brain like a muscle. What do we know about whether or not those actually work?
Yeah, and one of the things I love about the special section is sprinkled through it, there are all these little tidbits that you probably got an email from it or about it or saw it on Facebook, and we're actually looking at the real science associated with these anti-aging claims. And you're right, there's a ton of brain training exercises out there, and the science is actually pretty promising. They showed that people 65 and older who attended 10 one-hour brain training courses, they learned to, solve puzzle, memorize lists, those kinds of mental exercises. They show that 5 to 10 years later, most of the subjects maintained the gains in cognitive function that they exhibited when the courses were complete. So it looks like, it's a pretty light lift to say, hey, instead of watching TV and vegging out for an hour, try a Sudoku puzzle. I think all of us could manage that. And the effects appear to be not only definitive, but long-lasting. 5 to 10 years afterward, they're still, going strong.
And we worry about diet and whether that is linked to dementia. Those of us who say might have eaten 2 pieces of cake today might wonder, is there a link, between sugar and a long-term risk? Yeah, there was cake at the office. It happens. So does sugar have a link in the long run to dementia?
The short answer is maybe. The problem with sugar is that it changes the way your body responds to insulin because, generally speaking, the more sugar you eat, the more you put on weight, the more weight you put on, the bigger the fat cells get, so the fat cells start responding differently to insulin. And all of that ties into what we believe are some of the triggers for Alzheimer's. So it looks like there's a link, unfortunately. If you eat a lot of sweets, you might want to start cutting back on them and, going to maybe some delicious unsweetened tea or
yay.
Fruit. But I just want to say on the other side, something I was really excited to read when I saw this story is, there's another healthy aging claim that if you really restrict your calories to a very, very low level, even lower than a lot of people think is healthy, if you restrict your calories, you're going to increase your lifespan. The research on that says, maybe not. because there's really mixed results when they restricted calories for people. So I'm thinking, you know, don't give up the cake entirely, but just have one reasonable piece instead of the whole cake, you know?
Well, we're talking right now with Discover Magazine's Gemma Tarlak about the latest in cool science news. And we're starting out right now talking about what science has to say about the aging process and where the big advances are happening. And eyesight and hearing, Gemma, a couple of areas where we can see some downhill momentum come a certain age. What do we know about what science has to say about how we can stall that or maybe turn it around?
Well, just if you look, for example, with vision, pretty much everybody, when they hit the 50-year mark, your eye just goes through certain changes. It goes through degeneration. It's just the way it is. But now they're developing all these new techniques and potential therapies. And one of them that's actually already FDA approved, it's called the Argus II Retinal Prosthesis System, which is really cumbersome to say. So even the researchers call it the bionic eye. And they can actually, yeah, they can implant it. It's got, I don't want to get too deep into things, but it basically has a tiny little electronics system in there that helps where your the part of your eye that weakens with age, it kind of takes over for it and takes the same stimuli that that weakened part of your eye would look at and translate it so that your brain can understand it as if that part of your eye was functioning normally and at full strength. And that's just one of, you know, many, many promising therapies and treatments out there.
Well, moving on to another story, ancient footprints evidently are telling us a story about some of our distant, talking a million, couple million years ago, ancestors. What are we learning from footprints?
Yeah, well, you know, all over the world, there are these handful of sites where ancient footprints, either from humans, members of the genus Homo, or even earlier from Australopithecines, who lived, you know, 3-4 million years ago, we do actually have some of their footprints preserved. And the oldest site is 3.6 million years old. It's in northern Tanzania. And they're actually able now to use photogrammetry, which is a three-dimensional way of visualizing the footprint. And using that instead of, you know, the old-school casts where they would pour the plaster in and risk damaging the actual footprint, no. It's all digital now, and they can actually tell from the information they get not only how the foot was placed on the ground, but where the weight was distributed, how it lifted off the ground, all these really interesting things. And why is that important? Well, you know, one of the most important and unique things about our genus is that we developed the fully bipedal gait. Now, when did that happen? There's a lot of, you know, well, I don't know. What do you think? I don't know. There's a lot of controversy about when bipedal gait developed. And these really special footprints are helping us understand how it evolved.
And anything that we've gleaned so far about who these people, or at least these human ancestors, may have been and what their lives may have been like?
Not really, not that much, just because, you know, it's so far back. They can tell a little bit how they've walked. That's a big deal because it helps us, again, understand how we evolved to be fully bipedal. But, you know, it's interesting. There are some other footprints that have been found in places like Laetoli in Kenya and even in England, where you can see by the number of footprints and the size of the footprints, you can get an idea whether it was, say, a hunting party or perhaps a family, a mixture of adults and children. And that really kind of, you know, makes them a little, I think, more immediate. One of the folks we interview in the story, he's an ichnologist who looks at these ancient footprints, and he said, you know, you can't look at them without thinking, was this person hunting? Was this person playing? You know, what were they doing when they actually made this mark?
Well, we humans, our ancestors, developed this unique evolutionary trait of walking on two legs. You also wrote a piece, Gemma, about plants with a unique adaptation, eating living stuff, the flesh of animals. Tell us about the carnivorous plants.
Well, this is, you know, this is our October issue, and this is kind of our subtle little tip of the hat to Halloween, which, as you know, is my favorite holiday. And I just started wondering some questions about carnivorous plants. So I started, you know, going down the rabbit hole and digging up more and more research. Carnivorous plants, crazy, okay? There are 600 or more species of them. And we've got everything from the largest carnivorous plant, which is Borneo's Nepenthes raja, that can fit a half gallon of fluid in its pitcher. It's a pitcher plant type.
Wow.
Then there's this other, I mean, one of my favorites, I have to say, the bladderworts. They are the fastest carnivorous plants around, full stop. they couldn't even document how fast they were until they had high-definition video, because they opened this little trap underwater so quickly that the change in pressure just sucks the prey right inside, and then it closes just as quick. They couldn't even see that to document it until just a couple of years ago. So they're absolutely nuts, and they're all over. You've got probably either carnivorous or proto-carnivorous plants in your garden. It's very possible.
And there are plants also that you mentioned that have evolved sort of a fancy sideline to that. They start by luring the insect in to go to the bathroom with insect poop, and then that's how they get their food.
Yeah, it's terribly unglamorous, and I don't know if you want to talk about it on radio. But basically, you know, these famous pitcher plants pretty much evolved to be, if you can imagine it, kind of like toilet bowls. And, you know, the little animals sit on the rim munching on whatever delicious prey is caught up in the tendrils of the pitcher plant. And they do as animals do and, you know, get rid of their business. And that's actually what the plant has evolved to digest. So not tasty at all. I apologize to any listeners who are having like a snack right now, but yeah, they're pretty much their poop eaters.
Well, carnivorous plants, who knew? Gemma, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about it.
Thank you. Always fun.
That was Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us once a month to talk about some of the latest science headlines.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Today is International Literacy Day, a day earmarked to encourage people to celebrate the importance of reading. Wisconsin Literacy is recognizing this day with an event tonight in Green Bay. The event is part of their year-long celebration of their 30th anniversary.
And we're asking you, have you ever needed help learning to read? Where did you turn? Have you ever volunteered as a literacy tutor? Why'd you do it? What do you love about reading? You can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or share your story on the Central Time Facebook page.
Hannah Herlichka joins us now. She's a student of the Literacy Volunteers of Chippewa Valley, a literary agency that works with Wisconsin Literacy, and she's used their services for 5 years. Hannah, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you.
Tell us a little bit, if you could, about what made reading difficult for you initially.
Well, I found out at the age of 18 that I was dyslexic, so I went all throughout high school and middle school not knowing why I couldn't read very well as other kids. So once I found out I was dyslexic, I found Literacy Volunteers, and it's been absolutely amazing. I was reading at a fourth grade reading level, and now I'm in college going for nursing.
So when you first went to the Literacy Volunteers of Chippewa Valley, there you were, you're an 18-year-old. Was there a hurdle for you in admitting that you could use some work, even though you'd gone through high school?
Oh, yes. I was almost embarrassed because I always felt like I was stupid. But once I realized how to break down the words and actually found them out, and I feel very smart.
What were those volunteers like? How did they work with you?
They're absolutely amazing. They go above and beyond things to help you with. For me, I had a lot of struggles with the compass test with the math portion, and they did everything they could to help me achieve that and got me started on a course at the tech for algebra, and they've been absolutely amazing with books, supplies. I go there once a week to work on it, and I couldn't ask for anything more.
So you're still going there to work, sounds like.
Yep, here and there, but now that I started college, I don't go as much.
How long did it take you to feel kind of comfortable in that you were getting a handle on what your issues were and that you were surmounting them?
Probably 2 years. I went once a week for those 2 years, and we worked for about an hour and a half each time. But once I got the hang of it, I just kept going, and I don't stop reading, and I even like to read recipes or billboards now. And
how is your life different now, Hannah, now that you do have this comfort and this agility with reading that you didn't have before? What's changed?
Well, a lot has. I can do fractions now, which is with cooking. Now I can provide for my family in that way of cooking, and I can read to my daughter stories at night, which is a great feeling.
Well, Hannah, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about your experience.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That was Hannah Herlichka, student of the Literacy Volunteers of Chippewa Valley. She joined us to share her experience learning to read as an adult.
We'll continue our conversation now about literacy on International Literacy Day, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a story like Hannah's, or maybe someone in your family, your kid? What did you or they do to overcome that challenge? On the other side of things, have you ever worked as a literacy volunteer, help tutor someone, help them learn how to read? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Michelle Erickson joins us now. She's the Executive Director of Wisconsin Literacy. Michelle, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, tell us about Wisconsin Literacy. How does it work?
Well, we're a coalition of 76 literacy agencies across the state. Our mission is really to provide leadership, support, and a statewide voice for adult and family literacy efforts. And we do this in a lot of different ways, but we mostly provide training and resources and professional development, and we advocate for literacy as a cause worthy of support at the state capitol.
Now, for people who may go through their lives taking literacy for granted, can you tell us a little bit about what it means to people, what you've seen?
Well, literacy really, in its most basic form, is really simply a decoding skill that many people learn at a young age. But for so many others that have difficulties with this skill or don't have the opportunity to learn in skill, it becomes just a tremendous barrier to living a really fully engaged life. So if you were to think about the three basic human needs, food, shelter, and clothing, you can understand that obtaining these kind of necessities would be very difficult without reading and writing skills. So literacy and limited literacy are just closely related to a lot of other social struggles, you know, including poverty and high school dropout rates, crime, and even poor health status.
How do literacy rates look in Wisconsin right now?
In Wisconsin, we're just very slightly ahead of the national rates, but that's not really good news, I'm afraid to say. So 43% of Americans really read at the two lowest levels of literacy. In Wisconsin, it's closer to about 39%. And I know these numbers are really shocking to a lot of people, but the two lowest levels of literacy, the very lowest level of literacy, that means about 14% of the U.S. population really struggle to even fill out a basic form. And another 29% struggle to just read a bus schedule, cost comparison shop, point out information in a paragraph of an article.
So 39% in Wisconsin. How is that trending right now? Is Wisconsin improving its rates of literacy or moving in the other direction?
Well, we have actually, the National Center for Educational Statistics has been measuring this since 1993, again in 2003, and then the U.S. was involved in an international study in 2013. And over these last 30 years, unfortunately, we have not really moved the needle a whole lot in terms of, decreasing the rates a great deal.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that a lot of other issues play into how and why people learn to read or why they learn that they don't learn to read. I think our family structure has changed a lot over the last 30 years, and I think that's had an impact. I often quote a saying by Emily Buchwald that said, children become readers on the laps of their parents. And so I think that many times when we have adults that don't read and aren't in a position to read to their children, literacy or illiteracy is a cyclical issue, and it's really hard to develop these skills at such an early age when you're, if we look at child brain development, synapses and neurons and all those things are forming right from birth early on. 0 to 3 is a really important age. And so we need our parents to be readers themselves to read to their children is really one reason I think that that kids struggle. Adults who struggle have pretty much struggled all their lives in reading and writing, and it's you know, has started very early for them. And many have disabilities that, you know, that go undiagnosed. You know, Hannah mentioned she didn't know all through high school that she had dyslexia.
You mentioned the importance of early reading, and I think maybe a lot of us assume that if there are troubles, maybe dyslexia, that they're going to get caught once that child enters the school system. Why do you think that isn't always happening there?
Well, you know, we ask a lot of our school system in terms of, you know, really individually looking at all the issues that surround a child and their reading skills. And so I think that, you know, in large classrooms and well-behaved students, it's hard for teachers to really figure out every student's issue around this. And a lot of the learning disabilities require a medical diagnosis. And sometimes that's just very difficult to achieve and to seek out. Many of our students don't have, you know, some of the resources to get that diagnosis are often a challenge in and of itself.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Oki on the line with us in Paddock Lake. Hi there, Oki.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I like your subject because at the age of 23, I learned from my father giving me an article about learning disability, and Nelson Rockefeller, a lot of famous people had the learning disability too. At an early age, I was in the third grade. A teacher of mine seen I had trouble, and she asked my parents, and my parents told her to tell, ask me if I wanted to be held back. And I asked her, she asked me, and I said, what do you recommend? She goes, I like to hold you back. So she held me back. But at the age of 23, I still had the problem, and I was filing for unemployment because I was just out of service. And the guy who interviewed me handed me his letter and told me to sign it. And I started reading, and I couldn't read and couldn't pronounce comprehension. And I asked him what the word was and what it meant. And he called me an illiterate and stupid. And he said, you're old enough to know how to read. You're just stupid. You're just lazy. That's all. And I just looked at him. I said, sir, my parents told me respect my elders. I'm respecting you. And I got up and left.
And I'm sorry you went through that, Oki. Did things turn around for you at a certain point?
Yes. After that happened, I forced myself, started reading books about gardening and different subjects to better myself. And a lot of my coworkers and a lot of my friends asked me questions about gardening and different subjects. And I went to my books and read it and gave it their answer to them. And if I couldn't find it, I would go and try to research it and see what I can come up with. And at the age of 62, I graduated from Gateway with my associate's degree in human services. And
congratulations. That's a wonderful story, Oki. Thank you so much for sharing that with you. He's been on quite a journey with literacy in his life, didn't give up. Is that sort of typical of the kind of story that you hear, Michelle?
Yeah, many people at all kinds of, you know, ages and stages in their lives are really able to improve. Our programs all work one-on-one or small group settings, also class instruction, but the core of our programs, professionally trained volunteer tutors to work one-on-one with adults who've been struggling, and that individual attention and their, you know, eagerness to learn and change their lives has really made such a difference and how people, you know, discover reading skills later in life.
We're talking to Michelle Erickson from Wisconsin Literacy about helping others to read on this International Literacy Day.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you love about reading? What have you done to pass that love of reading on to your children, your grandchildren? Have you ever struggled to read? Has it been difficult for you? Have you gotten this kind of help, or have you provided literacy tutoring? Call 800-642-1234 or post on our Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion about reading on this International Literacy Day with Michelle Erickson of Wisconsin Literacy.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Have you ever volunteered to help someone learn how to read? Have you ever needed help learning how to read? Where did you go for that help? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go next to Nancy, who's joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I've been a volunteer for 8 years at Green Bay Literacy Center, and they help many people in this community. I chose to work with a lady from Mexico, and she wanted to improve her English and her reading skills so that she would be able to communicate within the community, especially with her daughter's teachers and doctors. And so it's been I'm a retired educator, so it's been a way for me to still use my skills.
And what has that experience been like for you, Nancy, especially as you realize you may be talking now to other people who might be thinking about tutoring in this way?
I can't praise it enough. It's just been wonderful for me. As a retired person, it gives me a bit of a schedule, something to do twice a week. We meet together for an hour and a half, and she has become a friend. We see each other twice a week for an hour and a half, and that makes us friends. It's just been a wonderful experience.
Well, thank you so much for calling and sharing your experience about that. And Michelle, let's talk about those volunteers. They're very important to your organization. What do you need to know if you want to become a tutor like Nancy is?
Well, really, becoming a tutor just involves the ability to read and write and patience and perhaps 2 to 3 hours of your time a week. All of our programs hold professional training sessions where volunteers from the community can learn the additional skills they would need to be a tutor. If you're tutoring someone from a foreign country, you do not need to know that language. You would develop the skills to communicate with that person without knowing their native language, and you'll soon find out that the English comes quickly at first in order to communicate. So really patience and understanding and empathy are, I think, the greatest qualities of becoming a tutor. There are many benefits as well. Working with students from other countries, you learn so much about their native country. It's like having a passport without really ever having to leave home. And you see people not just improve their reading skills, but just improve their whole their confidence, their outwardness, just feeling much better in everyday activities. And that's really rewarding to see.
Thank you for that call. Let's take another one now from Jason in Hudson. Hi, Jason.
Hey, y'all.
What do you think?
Well, I was just pointing out just something to not forget on the literacy is those who were literate and are no longer. I used to, as a teenager, volunteer in old folks' homes reading newspapers just in the public room. You know, there's those who can read, but their eyes are no longer able to, or their hands are not steady enough for them to read the paper, and it keeps them connected with the community. And it just you can see their eyes light up when somebody has taken the time with them, that they're not forgotten, and that this is not a lost step in their life.
Well, Jason, thank you so much for that. And Michelle, what do you want us to know about the needs of senior citizens when it comes to literacy and reading?
Well, I think Jason makes a really important point that it's a skill that if you've had all your life and struggled to then continue enjoying your love of reading, that's a huge loss. And it also makes it much harder to engage in the community. So that kind of volunteering is really important and really can make a difference.
It is International Literacy Day as we talk with Michelle Erickson, Executive Director of Wisconsin Literacy. They're celebrating their 30th anniversary this year. And Michelle, tonight it sounds like you're kicking off an annual statewide program called 1,200 Tutors in 12 Weeks. Can you tell us about that campaign?
Sure. It's a tutor recruitment campaign across the state. This is our 12th annual, and we're helping our members recruit volunteer tutors from their communities. These tutors then get trained from the literacy agency and matched with students like Hannah. And really, both the student and the tutor's life changed for the better. As we mentioned before, it's just a few hours a week. And to commemorate and kick off this campaign, many of our local programs are having open houses and events in their own communities.
And what tonight would you say? Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying tonight we're kicking off that 1,200 Tutors campaign. It runs for 12 weeks till December 1st here in Green Bay, as well as celebrating our 30th.
If someone out there is listening now and they're thinking about reaching out to your organization, maybe they have, like Hannah did earlier, a little bit of embarrassment about reaching out. Maybe they're a little older. What would you tell them to encourage them to take that move and why it's worth it?
Well, I would tell them that it will change their lives and help them to learn how to really engage with their family and work and their community in ways that that they just have never been able to feel comfortable doing before. So I think that it is worth the effort. It's a journey, but no one's ever too old to learn how to read.
Michelle, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
That was Michelle Erickson, Executive Director of Wisconsin Literacy. We also heard from Hannah Herlichka, a student of Literacy Volunteers of Chippewa Valley. We talked to them both this hour about literacy for the 30th anniversary of Wisconsin Literacy and also International Literacy Day. You can find out more about Wisconsin Literacy's event tonight on the Central Time Facebook page. Today is a big day in the history of pop culture and of TV and movie science fiction. On this day in 1966, the first episode of the original Star Trek series aired on NBC after a pair of pilot episodes that didn't make it to broadcast.
Here's the opening from the show that started 5 decades and counting of the Star Trek franchise.
Captain's log, stardate 1513.1. Our position, orbiting planet M113. On board the Enterprise, Mr. Spock, temporarily in command. On the planet, the ruins of an ancient and long dead civilization.
As we heard there, Kirk, and referencing Spock, don't forget the rest of the gang, Dr. McCoy, Scotty, Lieutenant Uhuru, and of course, Mr. Sulu.
And I gotta wonder if, you know, opening day, they finally get their show on the air, they would have had any idea of the phenomenon the Star Trek franchise and the fandom would become, or at all those people involved right at the outside, if they had any idea what that was going to be.
I gotta guess that they didn't, because they did not invest in quality costuming for the stars. Do you remember how initially
sets, yeah.
Well, their clothes shrank, and so by the end their pants were up to their knees and their shirts were at their elbows, and someone was going, man, we should have asked for a bigger wardrobe budget.
and they only made it 3 seasons too on the original show.
Is that all?
3 seasons, yeah. I looked it up on the interwebs.
Ah.
Yeah, but then the movies and the spin-off shows and so on, and now a cultural phenomenon. We'll go out with the original Star Trek theme here on Central Time.